Chapter 20. Odo lingered long on this image, but it was not till he stood beneath Piero della Francesca's portrait of the first duke that he felt the thrill of kindred instincts. In this grave face, with its sensuous mouth and melancholy speculative eyes, he recognized the mingled strain of impressionability and unrest that had reached such diverse issues in his cousin and himself. The great duke of the olden age, in his Titianesque brocade, the statuette of a naked faun at his elbow, and a faun-like smile on his own ruddy lips, represented another aspect of the ancestral spirit. The rounded temperament of an age of Cyrenaicism, in which every moment was a ripe fruit sunned on all sides. A little farther on, the shadow of the Council of Trent began to fall on the ducal faces, as the uniform blackness of the Spanish habit replaced the sumptuous colors of the Renaissance. Here was the persecuting bishop, Paul IV, apostrophe SLI against the Spaniards, painted by Caravaggio in hauberk and mailed gloves, with his motto Idem cum gladio surmounting the episcopal chair. There the duke who, after a life of hard warfare and stern piety, had resigned his office to his son, and died in the Angelica Vestis of the tertiary order, and the edified duchess who had sold her jewels to buy corn for the poor during the famine of 1670, and had worn a hair shirt under a corset that seemed stiff enough to serve all the purposes of bodily mortification. So the file descended, the colors fading, the shadows deepening, till it reached a baby Porporado of the last century, who had donned the cardinal's habit at 4, and stood rigid and a little pale in his red robes and lace, with a crucifix and a skull on the table to which the top of his beretta hardly reached. It seemed to Odo as he gazed on the long line of faces, as though their owners had entered one by one into a narrowing defile, where the sun rose later, and set earlier on each successive traveler, and in every countenance, from that of the first duke to that of his own peruqued and cuirassed grandfather, he discerned the same symptom of decadency. That duality of will which, in a delicately tempered race, is the fatal fruit of an undisturbed preeminence. They had ruled too long, and enjoyed too much, and the poor creature he had just left to his dismal scruples and foreboding seemed the mere empty husk of long-exhausted passions. 2.11. The Duchess was lodged in the Borromei wing of the palace, and thither Odo was conducted that evening. To eyes accustomed to such ceremonial there was no great novelty in the troop of powdered servants, the major domo in his short cloak and chain, and the florid splendor of the long suite of rooms, decorated in a style that already appeared overcharged to the more fastidious taste of the day. Odo's curiosity centered chiefly in the persons peopling this scene, whose conflicting interests and passions formed, as it were, the framework of the social structure of Pianura, so that there was not a laborer in the mulberry orchards, or a weaver in the silk looms, but depended for his crust of black bread, and the leaking roof over his head on the private whim of some member of that brilliant company. The Duchess, who soon entered, received Odo with the flighty good nature of a roving mind, but as her deep blue gaze met as her color rose, her eyes lingered on his face, and she invited him to a seat at her side. Maria Clementina was of Austrian descent, and something in her free and noble port, and the smiling arrogance of her manner recalled the aspect of her distant kinswoman, the young Queen of France. She plied Odo with 100 questions, interrupting his answers with a playful abruptness, and to all appearances more engaged by his person than his discourse. "Have you seen my son?" she asked. "I remember you a little boy scarce bigger than Ferrand, whom your mother brought to kiss my hand in the very year of my marriage." "Yes, and you pinched my toy spaniel, sir, and I was so angry with you, that I got up, and turned my back on the company, do you remember? But how should you, being such a child at the time? Ah, cousin, how old you make me feel! I would to God my son looked as you did then, but the duke is killing him with his nostrums. The child was healthy enough when he was born, But what with novenas and touching of relics and animal magnetism and electrical treatment, there's not a bone in his little body, but the saints and the surgeons are fighting over its possession. Have you read Emil, apostrophe cousin, by the new French author, I forget his name? Well, I would have the child brought up like Emil, apostrophe allowed to run wild in the country, and grow up sturdy and hard as a little peasant. But what heresies am I talking? The book is on the index, I believe, and if my director knew I had it in my library, I should be set up in the stocks in the marketplace, and all my court gowns burned at the church door as a warning against the danger of importing the new fashions from France. I hope you hunt, cousin? She cried suddenly. Apostrophe is my chief diversion and one I would have my friends enjoy with me. His Highness has lately seen fit to cut down my stables, so that I have scarce 40 saddle horses to my name, and the greater part, but sorry nags at that. Yet I can still find a mount for any friend that will ride with me, and I hope to see you among the number, if the Duke can spare you now, and then from Mass and benediction. His Highness complains that I am always surrounded by the same company. But is it my fault, if there are not 20 persons at court, that can survive a day in the saddle and a night at cards? Have you seen the Belverde, my mistress of the robes? She follows the hunt in a litter, cousin, and tells her beats at the death. I hope you like cards too, cousin, for I would have all my weaknesses shared by my friends, that they may be the less disposed to criticize them. The impression produced on the Duchess by the Cavalier Valseca was closely observed by several members of the group surrounding Her Highness. One of these was Count Tresker, who moved among the courtiers with an air of ease that seemed to establish without proclaiming the tie between himself and the Duchess. When Maria Clementina sat down at play, Tresker joined Odo, and with his usual friendliness pointed out the most conspicuous figures in the circle. The Duchess's society, as the Duke had implied, was composed of the livelier members of the court, chief among whom was the same Don Serafino who had figured so vividly in the reminiscences of Mirandolina and Cantapresto. This gentleman, a notorious loose liver and gamester, with some remains of good looks and a gay boisterous manner, played the leader of revels to Her Highness's following. And at his heels came the flock of pretty women and dashing spendthrifts who compose the train of a young and pleasure-loving princess. On such occasions as the present, however, all the members of the court were obliged to pay their duty to Her Highness, and conspicuous among these less frequent visitors was the Duke's director, the suave and handsome Dominican whom Odo had seen leaving His Highness's closet that afternoon. This ecclesiastic was engaged in conversation with the Prime Minister, Count Pave Pelago, a small feeble mannequin covered with gold lace and orders. The deference with which the latter followed the Dominican's discourse excited Odo's attention, but it was soon diverted by the approach of a lady who joined herself to the group with an air of discreet familiarity. Though no longer young, she was still slender and graceful, and her languid eye and vaporish manner seemed to Odo to veil an uncommon alertness of perception. The rich sobriety of her dress, the jeweled rosary about her wrist, and most of all, perhaps, the murderous sweetness of the smile with which the Duchess addressed her, told him that here was the Countess Belverde, an inference which Tresker confirmed. The Countess, said he, or I should rather say the Marchioness of Boscofolto, since the Duke has just bestowed on her the fief of that name, is impatient to make your acquaintance, and since you doubtless remember the saying of the Marquis de Montesquieu, that to know a ruler one must know his confessor and his mistress, you will perhaps be glad to seize both opportunities in one. The Countess greeted Odo with a flattering deference, and at once drew him into conversation with Pave Pelago and the Dominican. We are discussing, said she, the details of Prince Ferrand's approaching visit to the shrine of Our Lady of the Mountain. This shrine lies about half an hour's ride beyond my villa of Boscofolto, where I hope to have the honor of receiving their highnesses on their return from the pilgrimage. The Madonna del Monte, as you doubtless know, has often preserved the ducal house in seasons of peril, notably during the Great Plague of 1630, and during the famine in the Duchess Polixena's time, when Her Highness, of blessed memory, met Our Lady in the streets distributing bread, in the dress of a peasant woman from the hills, but with a necklace made of blood drops instead of garnets. Father Ignazio has lately counseled the little princess visiting in state the protectress of his line, and His Highness's physician, Count Heiligenstern, does not disapprove the plan. In fact, she added, I understand that he thinks all special acts of piety beneficial, as symbolizing the inward act by which the soul incessantly strives to reunite itself to the One. The Dominican glanced at Odo with a smile. The Count's dialectics, said he, might be dangerous were they a little clearer, but we must hope he distinguishes more accurately between his drugs than his dogmas. But I am told, the Prime Minister here interposed in a creaking rusty voice, that Her Highness is set against the pilgrimage, and will put every obstacle in the way of its being performed. The Countess sighed and cast down her eyes, the Dominican remained silent, and Tresker said quietly to Odo, Her Highness would be pleased to have you join her in a game at basset. As they crossed the room he added in a low tone, colon, the Duchess, in spite of her remarkable strength of character, is still of an age, to be readily open to new influences. I observed she was much taken by your conversation, and you would be doing her a service, by engaging her not to oppose this pilgrimage to Boscofolto. We have Heiligenstern's word, that it cannot harm the prince, it will produce a good impression on the people, and it is of vital importance to Her Highness, not to side against the Duke in such matters. And he withdrew with a smile as Odo approached the card table. Odo left the Duchess's circle with an increased desire to penetrate more deeply into the organization of the little world about him, to trace the operation of its various parts, and to put his hand on the mainspring about which they revolved. And he wondered whether Gamba, whose connection with the Ducal Library must give him some insight into the affairs of the court, might not prove as instructive a guide through this labyrinth as through the mazes of the Ducal Garden. The Duke's library filled a series of rooms designed in the classical style of the Cinquecento. On the very threshold Odo was conscious of leaving behind the trivial activities of the palace, with the fantastic architecture which seemed their natural setting. Here all was based on the noble permanence of taste, a convergence of accumulated effort toward a chosen end. And the door was fittingly surmounted by Seneca's definition of the wise man's state, colon, omnia illi secula ut deo serviant. Odo would gladly have lingered among the books which filled the rooms with an incense-like aroma of old leather. His imagination caressed in passing the yellowish vellum backs, the worn tooling of Alton folios, the heavy silver clasps of ancient chronicles and psalters. But his first object was to find Gamba, and renew the conversation of the previous day. In this he was disappointed. The only occupant of the library was the hunchback's friend and protector, the Abate Crescenti, a tall white-haired priest with the roseate gravity and benevolent air of a donator in some Flemish triptych. The Abate, courteously welcoming Odo, explained that he had dispatched his assistant to the Benedictine monastery to copy certain ancient records of transactions between that order and the lords of Valseca, and added that Gamba, on his return, should at once be apprised of the cavalier's wish to see him. The abate himself had been engaged, when his visitor entered, in collating manuscripts. But on Odo's begging him to return to his work, he said with a smile, colon, I do not suffer from an excess of interruptions, for the library is the least visited portion of the palace, and I am glad to welcome any who are disposed to inspect its treasures. I know not, Cavalier, he added, if the report of my humble labors has ever reached you, And on Odo's affirmative gesture he went on, with the eagerness of a shy man who gathers assurance from the intelligence of his listener, colon such researches into the rude and uncivilized past seem to me as essential to the comprehension of the present as the mastering of the major premise to the understanding of a syllogism. And to those who reproach me for wasting my life over the chronicles of barbarian invasions, and the records of monkish litigations, instead of contemplating the illustrious deeds of Greek sages and Roman heroes, I confidently reply that it is more useful to a man to know his own father's character than that of a remote ancestor. Even in this quiet retreat, he went on, I hear much talk of abuses, and of the need for reform, and I often think that, if they who rail so loudly against existing institutions would take the trouble to trace them to their source, and would, for instance, compare this state as it is today with its condition 500 or 1,000 years ago, instead of measuring it by the standard of some imaginary Platonic Republic, they would find, if not less subject for complaint, yet fuller means of understanding and remedying the abuses they discover. This view of history was one, so new in the Abate Crescenti's day, that it surprised Odo with the revelation of unsuspected possibilities. How was it that among the philosophers whose works he had studied, none had thought of tracing in the social and political tendencies of the race the germ of wrong so confidently ascribed to the cunning of priests and the rapacity of princes? Odo listened with growing interest while Crescenti, encouraged by his questions, pointed out how the abuses of feudalism had arisen from the small landowner's need of protection against the northern invader, as the concentration of royal prerogative had been the outcome of the king's intervention between his great vassals and the communes. The discouragement which had obscured Odo's outlook since his visit to Pontesordo was cleared away by the discovery that in a sympathetic study of the past might lie the secret of dealing with present evils. His imagination, taking the intervening obstacles at a bound, arrived at once at the general axiom to which such inductions pointed, and if he afterward learned that human development follows no such direct line of advance, but must painfully stumble across the wastes of error, prejudice and ignorance, while the theorizer traverses the same distance with a stroke of his speculative pinions, yet the influence of these teachings tempered his judgments with charity, and dignified his very failures by a tragic sense of their inevitableness. Crescenti suggested that Gamba should wait on Odo that evening, but the latter, being uncertain how far he might dispose of his time, inquired where the hunchback lodged, with a view of sending for him at a convenient moment. Having dined at the Duchess's table, and soon wearying of the vapid company of her associates, he yielded to the desire for contrast that so often guided his course, and set out toward sunset in search of Gamba's lodging. It was his first opportunity of inspecting the town at leisure, and for a while he let his curiosity lead him as it would. The streets near the palace were full of noble residences, recording, in their sculptured doorways, in the wrought iron work of torch holders and window grills, and in every architectural detail, the gradual change of taste that had transformed the machicolations of the medieval fighter into the open portals and airy balconies of his descendant. Here and there, amid these inveterate records of dominion, rose the monuments of a mightier and more ancient power. Of these churches and monasteries the greater number, dating only from the ascendancy of the Valsecas, showed an ordered and sumptuous architecture, but one or two buildings surviving from the period of the free city stood out among them with the austerity of desert saints in a throng of court ecclesiastics. The columns of the cathedral porch were still supported on featureless porphyry lions worn smooth by generations of loungers, and above the octagonal baptistery ran a fantastic basilisk wherein the spirals of the vine framed an allegory of men and monsters symbolizing, in their mysterious conflicts, the ever-recurring manichism of the Middle Ages. fresh from his talk with Crescenti, Odo lingered curiously on these sculptures, which but the day before he might have passed by as the efforts of ignorant workmen, but which now seem full of the significance that belongs to any incomplete expression of human thought or feeling. Of their relation to the growth of art he had as yet no clear notion, but as evidence of sensations that his forefathers had struggled to record, they touched him like the inarticulate stammerings in which childhood strives to convey its meaning. He found Gambas lodging on the upper floor of a decayed palace in one of the by-lanes near the cathedral. The pointed arcades of this ancient building enclosed the remains of floriated moldings, and the walls of the court showed traces of fresco painting. But clotheslines now hung between the arches, and about the well-head in the center of the court sat a group of tattered women with half-naked children playing in the dirt at their feet. One of these women directed Odo to the staircase which ascended between damp stone walls to Gamba's door. This was opened by the hunchback himself, who, with an astonished exclamation, admitted his visitor to a scantily furnished room littered with books and papers. A child sprawled on the floor, and a young woman, who had been sewing in the fading light of the attic window, snatched him up as Odo entered. Her back being turned to the light, he caught only a slender youthful outline, but something in the turn of the head, the shrinking curve of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.